It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Rain has been falling over the southeast this spring, but the area is still in a drought, especially the state of Georgia. Lake Lanier, Atlanta's largest source of drinking water, is more than 14 feet below the normal level. But in Clayton County, which is south of Atlanta, people are not so worried. Nearly two decades ago, this county began building an unusual water treatment system that includes wetlands and reservoirs. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
For the last couple of years, people across the southeast have faced one of the most severe droughts on record. In Georgia, you couldn't water your lawn. You couldn't wash your car in your driveway. The state even talked about shutting down swimming pools this year. And some worried the area would run out of drinking water. But one community didn't have to worry.
I like to say it's raining every day in Clayton County because we're putting right now about 10 million gallons back in our water supply.
Mike Thomas is general manager of the Clayton County Water Authority. He says reservoirs here are full and have never been in danger. That's because in the 1980s, folks realized there wasn't enough water to support the growth. So they decided to build a system of wetlands and reservoirs that would help them save water. In Jonesboro, Georgia, on a hilly patch of 4,000 acres, surrounded by tall pine trees, the county graded the land and built pools to filter the water. It's pumped in from a treatment plant and flows into a pond filled with all kinds of thick vegetation, including cattails, native grasses, and water lilies.
You can see right down here where the water's bubbling up, that's where the treated wastewater is entering the wetland cell, and then it'll gradually work its way through the entire cell, drop down to the next one, come back across, and usually work its way through about four cells. And that gives it plenty of exposure to the plants and the animals that kind of help remove any additional pollutants or nutrients that might still be in the water.
The water looks clear and doesn't smell bad. In fact, there have been no complaints from neighbors about the odor, but about something else entirely.
Really, the only complaint we've had was too much noise from the frogs at night. And so some of the noises you're hearing today, even during the daytime, are frog noises. So at night, when they really get active, it can really get noisy because there's so many frogs.
Before these wetlands were built, the county used an extensive sprinkler system, spraying wastewater in the forest and letting nature filter out the impurities. But Mike Thomas with the Clayton County Water Authority says the old system was expensive and the county was running out of forest land.
You know, before we were maintaining all these pipelines and sprinklers, now about the only maintenance activity we do out here is to mow the grass, and we usually only do that maybe two to three times during the summer. We're not trying to keep it like a manicured lawn. We're just trying to keep weeds and trees from growing up in places we don't want them. So Mother Nature and gravity takes care of the rest.
From here, the water runs over a gate and into a reservoir, one of four that were built to store billions of gallons of water. Residents use about 26 million gallons of water a day, and through this system, the county is able to reclaim 10 million gallons of that. The price tag is also an advantage. It can be as little as half the cost of building a regular wastewater treatment plant. It probably won't work for bigger cities like Atlanta because you need a lot of land. Still, it's attractive for smaller communities, and there's an added benefit. Officials can create a nature preserve for those who live nearby. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
In another part of the country, scientists are trying to check the spread of a disease. It's called white nose syndrome, and it could wipe out some species of bats in the Northeast. Brian Mann reports from North Country Public Radio.
A little over 3 months have passed since researchers first confirmed that white nose syndrome was infecting bats in Massachusetts, New York, and western Vermont, killing 90% of the animals in some caves. Biologist Susie Von Ottingen with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says they've made little progress understanding the disease.
We are still in the dark with what this is.
Scientists were hoping that the outbreak would be limited to small pockets of remote caves, but a rash of newly infected sites, including caves in Connecticut, has killed much of that optimism. The fear, says Von Ottingen, is that white nose is spreading toward core habitats as far away as Ohio and Virginia and could decimate crucial populations of endangered Indiana bats.
If we knew that it was an environmental factor that was unique to the Northeast, then maybe we wouldn't have to be concerned. But because we don't know, we really do have to watch those adjacent states very closely.
Scientists don't know that much about the diseases that affect bats. Some of the dying animals exhibit a crust of white fungus on their noses, but others simply look emaciated or disoriented. While researchers scramble to dissect hundreds of infected bat carcasses, volunteers have been enlisted to see if some of the ailing animals can be kept alive.
When we get the bats out, we have to weigh them, so we put them in a little dish like this.
Kathy Lara was an amateur wildlife rehabilitator in Hudson Falls, New York, an hour outside of Albany. Sitting in a bedroom in her home that's been converted into a makeshift clinic, Lara is preparing to feed a tiny bat.
So we got to get some extra food into him. They're all been tagged. But you sit here and they should eat 6 to 8, either mealworms or grubs.
Two of Lara's bats have already died. Three others seem to be gaining strength. Environmentalists say volunteer efforts like this one are a sign that government agencies haven't moved fast enough to protect these animals, especially endangered Indiana bats. Despite the rapid spread of white nose syndrome, the Fish and Wildlife Service still hasn't appointed a full-time staff person to coordinate the response. Earlier this month, a coalition of green groups threatened to sue the federal government under the Endangered Species Act if more isn't done. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in Northern New York.
I'm just downloading this video that shows an abandoned mine in New York State where bats live and die mysteriously. You can get a look for yourself at npr.org.
As Earth Week ends, Americans have been trying to find ways to soften our ecological impact. But according to Weekend Edition essayist Diane Roberts, some grassroots solutions are not popular with everyone.
You mosey out into your backyard to see if any more leaves from that stupid oak tree have fallen into your pool. You glance over the neighbor's fence, and there it is. Laundry. Pillowcases, camisoles, blue jeans, brassieres, bath towels, t-shirts, dress shirts, sweatpants, pajamas, hanging brazenly from a clothes line, right there for everyone to see. You are pretty sure the subdivision covenant outlaws clotheslines. It is a known fact that clotheslines are unsightly, tacky. Clotheslines depress property values. Let in clotheslines, and the next thing you know, it'll be pink plastic lawn flamingos, chickens on the back porch, a wheelless Chevy Nova up on concrete blocks in the front yard, 23 cousins from the old country living in the family room. Chaos. They call it the right to dry movement. They tell you America has at least 88 million tumble dryers. Those 88 million tumble dryers produce 2,224 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions per year. They say you can help slow down global warming if you'll just hang your washing out. They claim a clothesline is part of good environmental citizenship, using solar and wind power instead of an electrical appliance. It's cheaper, they chirp. Your sheets will smell like sunshine. They say, what's the big deal with people's Fruit of the Looms flapping gently in the breeze? After all, starlets and celebutantes are always showing off their panties and other intimate garments. They point out that in many parts of Italy and Spain, they just string the clotheslines from window to window over the street. And their cultures haven't exactly gone to wreck and ruin. Well, this isn't Italy or Spain. This is Sunny Meadow Estates. This is a place with rules. This is a place where everyone gets along because no one knows who wears a thong or a flannel nightie. A place where the difference between boxers and briefs is shrouded in decent obscurity. Where the tumble dryer is not only a household convenience, but an instrument of moral rectitude. The clothesline radicals can insist they're saving the planet. But they'll have to pry my cold, dead fingers from my box of Downy April Fresh dryer sheets.
Diane Roberts lets it all hang out in Tallahassee, Florida sunshine. This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block.
This
This week, we conclude our year-long series, Climate Connections. In more than 200 stories, NPR and National Geographic have examined the past, present, and future of global warming. We've asked how people are affected, what kinds of solutions are out there, even how climate can shape our own evolution. One thing climate experts often say is that to slow climate change, we need to change the way we live. But selling that message to the public hasn't been easy. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this profile of a man who argues that religion, not science or politics, is the perfect climate change messenger.
Martin Palmer leads the way into a churchyard in a tiny village called Ashbrittle in West England.
And this is where we come to the yew tree.
He's brought me here to see this ancient yew. It stands in the shadow of an old stone church. Like the church, he says, the yew represents staying power.
This extraordinary tree we're looking at in front of us here is somewhere between 3,500 and 3,800 years old.
So old that its branches have folded over and rooted themselves into the ground to form a sort of nave around the original trunk. Palmer steps inside.
But isn't it amazing to stand embraced inside a tree? I just think it's astonishing.
Astonishing also because this tree survived several ecological disasters, such as the Little Ice Age between the 14th and 19th centuries.
Appalling weather. It was freezing cold, incredibly wet. The crops rotted in the fields. And then, of course, you had the added joy of the Black Death.
Palmer is tall, ruddy, wears muddy boots, and laughs easily. He's the founder of the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, a small group working out of Bath, England. Their credo is that religions, from Buddhism to Zoroastrianism, are like the yew tree, in for the long haul. They can tackle long-lasting problems, like climate change. They also know how to talk to people, and not with scientific data.
There are tens of thousands of scientists who do that perfectly well. What we want to bring is the passion, the commitment, and the interpretation of meaning that religion brings to that data.
Palmer says faiths can be very different on the subject of nature. Some see humans as stewards of the earth. Others believe the opposite, that nature protects humans.
Both of those call for us to take our share of responsibility.
So Palmer and his colleagues at the Alliance travel the globe. They cajole religious leaders to learn about climate change and take the message to their followers. Those leaders bring more to the table than faith, though. Palmer says they control as much as 7% of the world's forests, forests that help curb global warming.
We have in Cambodia Buddhist monks ordaining trees as monks.
Thus conferring protection.
Exactly.
When you're talking about a change in the environment that's global, how much difference are a few trees in a religious sanctuary going to make?
Well, when we talk about a few trees, the Shinto own 2.4 million hectares of forest in Japan, so it's not inconsiderable. But I think let's also look at the faiths as major investors. Well, the religions of the world are the third major identifiable investing group in the world.
The Alliance advises church leaders on how to invest in green projects and to log their forests in a more environmentally friendly way. They've helped Sikhs in India find alternatives to fossil fuel for their network of kitchens for the poor. They look for messages about nature in each faith. Palmer found his own faith as a child. He grew up in a working-class public housing project. When he was about 10 years old, he had a fight with his parents, and he ran off. He ended up at Wells Cathedral, one of England's finest.
Because I needed to be in a place of beauty. And as I walked in, evensong began. This sublime music that just stopped me in my tracks. And there's a wonderful phrase that the Orthodox use. They say, "We knew not whether we stood on earth or in heaven."
Today, Palmer brings his view of earth and heaven into the pulpit of his own church.
We're just walking up this very ancient lane to our church, and there's probably been a church on this site for something like 1,600 years.
It's 200 yards from his house.
Good morning, good morning.
Inside, he has about a dozen parishioners bundled up in winter coats.
Because, as you all know, we are a carbon-neutral church. That is, we have absolutely no heating whatsoever. We rely on thermal underwear and body heat. So,
Palmer says priests and rabbis and imams know how to explain complicated abstract ideas in parable and metaphor. Today he tells a creation story from the ancient Jewish text, the Talmud.
The Talmud says that the angels went to God and said, "You've just created this wonderful world, and now you've created these human beings who will only go and mess it up. Are you stark staring mad?" And God says, "I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing." But then the earth spoke, and the earth was afraid. And the earth said, "These creatures, they will only rebel against me and harm me." And God answers, "I promise you that they will never be allowed to destroy you."
And Palmer sees it as his job to help God keep that promise.
Let's be off.
After church, he laces up his muddy boots and walks an old Roman path. Romans grew grapes here. The climate was warmer then. Experts say it will be again. But Palmer says experts don't necessarily know how to get people to do anything about it.
The predominant model that the environmental movement, which is quintessentially, its origins are entirely in the West, is sin and guilt, topped by a good dollop of end-of-the-world language.
Instead, he says, people need to celebrate nature as well and their place in it. That's a message that resonates with the United Nations, which is collaborating with the Alliance. UN officials say they need people who can speak about climate change straight from and to the heart. Martin Palmer says that's a job he can do, with help from monks, priests, ministers, and clerics of all faiths.
My understanding of my God, and I work with many, many different religious traditions, is that my God is not there to solve the problems. My God is there to say, "You are co-creators with me. Now work out what that means." It is not about, if we pray hard enough to God, he will end climate change. Yes, we should pray to God. We should also get off our backsides, get out there and do something about it.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Steve, it's coming to an end. Our year-long trek around the globe with National Geographic, and we've been calling Climate Connections. In our last few stories, we're looking to the future, and today we go to India,
which has a lot of new problems that come along with rapid development. India also has a lot of new problem solvers, though. Young Indians born in America, Britain, and Australia are traveling back to India. That's where they're going to work for startup companies or NGOs, non-governmental organizations. They're tackling pollution and carbon emissions and recycling and energy. NPR's Robert Krolwich meets some of India's climate change generation.
If you go to India to see water pollution projects, air pollution projects, green architecture projects, global warming initiatives, what you find naturally are lots of young Indians working away, but surprisingly often, right there with them on the front lines are kids who look Indian until they open their mouths. For example, Preeth Gowder.
I'm a venture capitalist.
Is a young guy who lends money to the poor.
Are you an Indian? You're an Indian.
Yeah, yeah. I consider India home. As soon as I come
you
into the city...
You don't sound Indian, though.
I don't. I was born in Alabama, and...
as so many Indians are.
Right.
And you?
My name is Ranu Sinha, and I'm a consultant.
My name is Dave Madden, or Dave Madanan in Indian context. My mom and dad are both from India.
At a restaurant in a Delhi neighborhood, I ran into a bunch of these folks and their friends who are part of a growing wave of British, Australian, and American-born Indians who've decided to move to India.
I'm not just someone walking around with an American accent talking about social development just to be cool, that I'm actually going to do something about it.
Their friends in India, local Indians, have a nickname for these Americans. They call them ABCDs, American-born confused Desis. Desis is an Indian slang word. It describes a new arrival searching for his inner Indianness, says Indian Gaurav Shori.
So what ends up is an American-born confused Desi.
And you know a lot of these guys and women?
Thank God I don't know.
Why? What's wrong with them? This is a long story, but because of their American diplomas, very much honored here, these returnees get terrific jobs in India, better jobs than the local young Indians get.
The ABCDs, by virtue of their accent and style and having lived in the West, are given a lot more importance by the social upper social strata in India as well. So they kind of get their due importance and they get their, I'm sure they get a lot more women than we do.
They get your women.
as well. So... Which is the case, because where I read about this, it was really crazy. Maxim India ran this amazing article about how the ABCDU comes, by virtue of having eaten beef most of his life, he's bigger than the normal Indian guy, and he has this deeper voice, and he dresses well, and he's got an accent, so the chicks fall for him.
The chicks fall for him.
I love that. It was brilliant. It was really awesome.
But his less jealous moments, Gaurav says, well, the truth is, India needs these young Americans and these Western kids because they know stuff that the young Indians don't know.
They come with amazing perspectives, amazing insights that Western countries have experienced over their development cycle, which India is going through now and making a lot of the mistakes that the West made, say, perhaps 20, 30 years back. So the insights that we get from these people are extremely beneficial to us.
So take this situation. Any day on the streets of Delhi, you can see a crush of new cars, new stores, bigger and bigger malls. All signs that the economy here is growing very fast. And most young Indians, says Ranu, they like it that way.
We're growing and we like this growth and it's exciting. And no, we don't want to hear doomsday stories about some glacier melting in the future and coasts, sea levels rising 20, 30 years from now. We don't want anything that will stop this growth.
If you drive to the south end of Delhi, a neighborhood that 9 years ago, by the way, was empty.
Literally just desert and sand and there were no buildings.
Now it is a strip of 10, maybe 15 shopping malls that are titanic in size. I went there with a young Indian, Leon Marinas.
I mean, look at the vastness of it is really echoing, right?
And do your friends like it in a place like this? I mean, would they?
Yeah, because this is exactly what they aspire for. I mean, Domino's is here, Pizza Hut is there.
And so is the plastic, and so are the cups and the bottles and the wrapping paper.
Plastic bags, trash in terms of non-biodegradables. That's new, and people don't really understand what to do with that.
Typically, trash was picked up by a special group called rag pickers, but there's now so much trash, they can't collect it all.
I had no idea how waste worked in Delhi.
So Carolyn Howe asked her landlord,
what do we do with our waste? Like, do you have a setup with the rag pickers in the neighborhood? Where do you leave the waste? He said, just throw it off the roof. That was the moment I decided I was going to move out. But it was also, and he did. He just threw, instead of paying 30 rupees, 75 cents a month to have someone pick up our trash, he threw it off the balcony onto these train tracks.
This happens all the time, says Indian Neeraj Doshi. People will keep a clean house.
But the problem is the responsibility lies only until my boundary. Beyond that, that's not my area. So
if it leaves my house, it's not my problem.
Exactly.
So there's a lack of we-ness of community that the Western kids particularly seem to notice and they think needs to be addressed.
And it's as simple as that. It's a conversation that needs to happen between people.
And to start that conversation, for example, Neeraj, working with a young Westerner, hopes to finance a new garbage collection company. And meanwhile, his friends, they talk about using movies to raise consciousness.
A good Bollywood movie on climate change here would really kind of increase awareness, in my own perspective.
Maybe Alexis Ringwald is right, but her friend Preet thinks she's wrong. Actors don't create lasting change.
What they want from movie stars is kind of their glamour for the 10 minutes.
But these conversations between young Americans and British and Indians, they can change minds. Young people talking together are critical for new ideas in India, he thinks.
I hear these conversations happening here. I don't hear them anywhere else.
But because they are so constant and so intense, these young friendships may create a new kind of we, a pan-Indian we-ness, says Neeraj.
Yeah, the we is all of us. All of us is we, and that's what my thing is. We are all of us are we.
And who knows, this conversation could go on for a while.
And it's why I'm here now. It's why I'm probably going to spend the majority of the rest of my life here.
I would be one of the same. I
this is going to be part of my life for the rest of my life.
Well, we'll see about that, because, you know, it's very trashy here and cranky and difficult.
It's not. It's far more beautiful, stunning, it's amazing, it's frustrating. It's diverse, it's complicated, and it's mine.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Much more Climate Connections is at npr.org/climate.
Climate change is just beginning. Younger people will see more of it than the rest of us. We're talking with that generation in this final month of NPR's Climate Connections series with National Geographic. This morning, we meet a recent college graduate from Costa Rica. He's spending a full year traveling the world, visiting small communities that may become more vulnerable as the globe warms up. As often happens with such trips, things have not turned out quite as planned. NPR's Dan Charles has the story.
Juan Hofmeister is a citizen of Costa Rica and a recent graduate from College of the Atlantic in Maine. Last summer, he received a Watson Fellowship, a grant to travel for 1 year, and he laid out his itinerary. Fiji, Vietnam, Cambodia, the southern tip of India, all places where millions of lives could be disrupted by rising sea levels, shifting rainfall patterns, or more powerful storms.
I really was trying to understand how can we find global solutions.
At the end of it, he thought, I'll write a report about some of the best things that local communities are doing to cope with a changing climate. Maybe those examples will inspire others. Last July, he set off.
I started the journey thinking that I was going to go out there and collect success stories. Within a matter of a couple months, I realized that what I was collecting was survival stories.
He arrived in Vietnam right after a devastating storm, Typhoon Likima. Hofmeister watched farmers trying to salvage the pitiful remnants of a rice crop, people sleeping on roads because everything else was covered with water.
There were some pretty tough moments, long days, and sometimes just not being able to fall asleep after seeing the terrible reality in which people were living, and just wondering if there was anything that we could do better.
But another part of Vietnam inspired him. In the mountains of the north, near the border with China, he found villages that seemed untouched by the outside world, mountainsides sculpted centuries ago into fertile terraces, people who welcomed him into their homes. One meal in particular sticks in his memory.
The head of the household came in and she asked me if I liked duck.
Yes, I like duck, he said, not quite realizing he'd soon be eating the duck, the one he'd just seen swimming in the rice paddy. The way these villagers lived, and they've lived this way for generations, seemed to Hofmeister like a sign of hope.
And they made me, for just a few weeks of my life, see the world through their eyes and see a world where respect for each other is very important, where the respect for your elders defines how you live your life, a way of life where you were so aware of what everything that you do every day means for your survival.
So it hit him even harder when he realized these villages are doomed. The central government of Vietnam plans to build a dam nearby to generate electricity. It will flood this valley.
In a matter of a year or two, it's all going to be underwater. These people were not given the choice. The decision was made for them, and they don't even get a chance to complain. I realized it was just not fair.
Now, even before this trip, Juan Hofmeister had traveled the world. He was ready, he says, for culture shock.
But I was not prepared for the livelihood shock. I was not prepared to see how marginalized people can be. And nothing can prepare you to see the injustices that you see in a lot of these communities.
So what happens next?
For a few days, Hofmeister is back among people wearing suits and polished shoes. He's attending a United Nations conference on adapting to climate change at a swank hotel in Port of Spain, Trinidad. The chair of the meeting, Helen Plume from New Zealand's Ministry for the Environment, is wrapping things up.
The Secretariat, under my guidance, will analyze the rich material obtained during this meeting.
Hofmeister has been to a lot of international conferences like this, representing an activist group called Sustain Us. But he confesses after his travels he finds such meetings increasingly frustrating. He's not sure anymore that the words the experts throw around,
food security or water access or even climate change mean much to a villager in Vietnam. What that villager wants is something to eat when crops fail. Also, a government that listens. It was simpler before he met all these people to talk about adaptation to climate change. His trip has been disturbing and confusing. But Hofmeister says he hasn't abandoned his conviction that we can make things better.
And perhaps I just think so because I just saw that these people, regardless of how many times they lost everything, they still had the energy to stand up again and start all over. And if they can do that, there has to be a way in which we can help them.
Juan Hofmeister is now in southern Africa, in Namibia. He'll continue on to Mozambique. And then he says he'll still write that report on his trip. It just won't be the report that he imagined a year ago. Dan Charles, NPR News.
You can take a trip around the globe with Juan Hofmeister on our website, npr.org/climateconnections. You'll find a slideshow of his stories from Fiji, Vietnam, and India.